Tonight we proved that when the people rise up and stand together, we can beat the special interests.
Yes, they did. In Wisconsin.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Yep.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Today it is.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with
From
you.
Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, and in Cottage Grove on Queso. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, on Maui, Hawaii on KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Grand Rapids, Michigan's WPRR, New Orleans, WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, Seattle, Washington's KODX, Red Bluff and Redding, California's KFOI, Round Mountain, California's KKRN, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on your internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, and Detour Talk, Blanketing Planet Earth, 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast, and I think this may actually qualify as a thrilling one for a pleasant change.
Yay.
Yeah, no kidding. That, of course, is our thrilled producer, Desi Doyen. How are you, Des?
I'm thrilled.
All right, well, let's start here. In a special election this past January, a Democrat won a long-held Republican seat in the Wisconsin State Senate, in a district that had gone to Donald Trump by like 20 points back in 2016. Last week, we discussed how Wisconsin's Governor Scott Walker had been so freaked out by that loss, after which he went on a Twitter rampage declaring the loss a wake-up call, a wake-up call. He was so freaked out by it that he refused to call special elections to fill two other state legislative seats in deeply red areas of Wisconsin, which had become vacant after Walker appointed those two legislators to his own administration. Walker was recently ordered last week by a judge, actually, I think 2 weeks ago now, a judge that he had appointed, by the way. He was ordered by that judge to schedule those two special elections, but he and the Republican majority state legislature tried instead to call a special session of the legislature in order to actually change the state law on special elections rather than call these two special elections that the court had ordered. Two other state judges excoriated Walker and the Republicans for trying to avoid the rule of law and the court orders last week. So Walker was finally forced late last week to schedule those two special elections for this June, whether he wanted to or not. And today, following spring state and local elections in Wisconsin on Tuesday, we have yet another reminder about why Badger State Republicans are so desperate to avoid any elections these days for as long as they can. Rebecca Dallet trounced Michael Skrenek on Tuesday for a 10-year term on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, shrinking the court's conservative majority and giving Democrats a jolt of energy heading into the fall elections, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It marked the first time in 23 years that a liberal candidate who wasn't an incumbent won a seat on the high court. In her victory speech, Dallet, a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge, attributed her win to Wisconsin voters standing up to special interests.
Friends, I ran with two things in mind. We need to restore independence to the judiciary, and we have to put Wisconsin values front and center. And that's what I've talked about. that's what I've talked about throughout the entire campaign. Special interests definitely are having their impact, and it's on both sides of the aisle. That's why I pledged I will recuse myself if any of those special interests that supported me appear before me. Tonight, we proved that when the people rise up and stand together, we can beat the special interests. We beat the NRA. And we beat the millions of dollars that were spent on this race flooding into our state. And it's by taking these strong stands that we can restore the reputation and the independence of our judicial branch.
Well, that's got to be scary for Wisconsin Republicans. Dalit's sizable victory margin alarmed Republican Governor Scott Walker enough that he posted a series of messages on Twitter once again, warning that he, this time, could be the victim of a, quote, blue wave this fall. With 100% of the wards reporting, Dalit defeated Skrenik by a full 12 points, 56 to 44, according to the unofficial returns. Dalit's win will mean six of the court's justices will now be women. Only one other state, Washington State, has that many women on its high court. But in percentage terms, Wisconsin will now have the highest representation of women because Wisconsin's court has a total of seven seats. Washington's has nine. Dalit was endorsed by the court's two other liberals. While most of the conservatives on the court back Skrenik, she also secured the endorsements of Vice President Joe Biden, former Attorney General Eric Holder, U.S. Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey. And as is the case these days, especially in Wisconsin, it drew outside spending that was expected to exceed $2 million. Skrenik, for his part, was endorsed by Walker, by GOP party money that made up nearly half of his fundraising. And both the National Rifle Association and Wisconsin's powerful Manufacturing and Commerce Association spent big for him as well. But it was not enough to overcome yet another sign of what could, I emphasize, could portend a blue wave for Democrats in this year's crucial midterm elections. If Walker thought a small little Senate district up in the northwestern part of the state going Democratic for the first time since 1995 was a wake-up call, said Wisconsin Democratic operative Scott Ross, referring to that special election back in January that flipped a long-held GOP seat from red to blue. And freaked out Scott Walker in the bargain. If he thought that was a wake-up call, said Ross, this would be a Category 8 hurricane. Joining us now is journalist and occasional political meteorologist John Nichols. He is Washington correspondent for The Nation, contributing writer for The Progressive, and in these times, he's associate editor of Madison, Wisconsin's Capital Times, and the author of many books on progressive politics. His latest is Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. I am happy to welcome Wisconsin's favorite son back to the broadcast. Oh, Mr. Nichols, welcome, sir.
Hey, sir. It's an honor to be with you, and I must say it's especially nice to be talking about something good happening in Wisconsin.
Right?
Rather than our many complex and sad stories. In fact, yeah. A friend of mine and I were calculating last night that last night was the first genuinely good election night for Wisconsin progressives since 2012.
Well, including that January win, because that was a big deal in
that
January.
That was a great deal, but you understand, that was one district.
Right.
You know, that was one, you know, 33rd of the state.
Right.
Right. It was a small portion, and it was great, and people took it very seriously, but you know as well as I, Brad, that the dynamics of a particular district, a good candidate, you know, some unique factors, can be, you know, you have to be a little careful extrapolating from that.
Right.
But when you've got a night where the governor's hand-picked candidate, and I would emphasize, the Skrenik guy, he was the governor's, he represented the Walker administration's position in cases on Walker's anti-labor legislation, as well as the Republican gerrymandering of the state legislature. So, I mean, this isn't just some conservative judge picked out of the mix. This is literally a point man for much of Walker's agenda. When that guy gets beat overwhelmingly in a race where he had all the traditional pieces of the Republican puzzle put together, the NRA, the corporate types, the anti-choice types, and then parallel to that, less well covered nationally, when the governor's proposal to eliminate the elected state office of state treasurer, which oversees a $1.2 billion trust fund for public education and public schools, and 77,000 square miles of public lands in the state, with his proposal to eliminate that office is defeated 62-38 by people who did not want to give him more power. You combine that, that's not a bad night.
No, that is not a bad night. And I was going to say to you, you know, don't you dare get my listeners excited here unless there's really something that they should be excited about. But it certainly sounds like it should. I mean, going into this, I was looking at this. John, you and I have covered so many of these Wisconsin Supreme Court races that look like Democrats or the liberals or the progressives, whatever you want to call them, had a chance. And then it didn't work out. This was quite the opposite. Let me get your response, John Nichols, to Scott Walker's panicked tweets after this election on Tuesday night. He said, tonight's results show we are at risk of a blue wave in Wisconsin. The far left is driven by anger and hatred. And he added in a second tweet, big government special interests flooded Wisconsin with distorted facts and misinformation. Next, they'll target me and work to undo our bold reforms. Of course, Walker is himself on the ballot this November for re-election. Your response from the angry and hatred-filled far left, John Nichols?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. Right? I mean, that guy packs a lot into it.
Yes, he does.
Almost as much as his president, Donald Trump.
Right.
But here's the deal. First and foremost, I think it's quite remarkable that a Republican politician is using the term blue wave. I mean, I don't usually see that on conservative and Republican social media.
Hashtag blue wave, he even used.
Yeah, and so it's very interesting. And what that tells you, what I would suggest to you, is that this guy is really obsessing about this stuff. You know, he knows the language of the other side. He knows the language of, you know, what you know, the Daily Coast folks are talking about. And it suggests he's spending a lot of time on this. And there's a reason for that. Just as you saw with his Twitter storm back in January, now again reacting to this night so overwhelmingly. One of the most disciplined political figures in the United States, a guy who really, by any measure, keeps his calm through some of the toughest political fights you've seen, appears to be losing it. And he appears to be freaked out by election results that he can't control. And for this guy, remember, he has been on something of a winning streak for quite a long time. Obviously, his presidential race crashed and burned. But in Wisconsin, he's known how to game this thing, to put the pieces together. And I think what you're seeing here is someone who, because of the changing national dynamics and the changing state dynamics, no longer knows how to put the pieces together. And so he's A, you know, scared about a blue wave, B, talking about the far left and all this scary stuff. You know, the fact of the matter is, that the woman who won the Supreme Court seat, Rebecca Dowett, she was the moderate candidate in the primary. There really was a lefty running. Who got, a guy named Tim Burns, an extremely honorable, very, very good lawyer, who got about 20% of the vote but didn't win the primary. Dowett came in second, and then Skrenik came in first. And so throughout the race, Dowett positioned herself as the experienced judge who wanted to restore integrity and independence to the high court. That did not mean that she wasn't outspoken, and we should talk a little about some of that because it's very important.
Mm-hmm.
But what it does mean is that to position her as the far left, this is a woman who ran with the support of, you know, dozens and dozens of county judges from across the state, that was backed by county sheriffs and, you know, I mean, in newspapers around the state. She was hardly the far left.
That's what I wanted to ask you. Actually, I want to get into in a second this idea of these elections for judges at all, because I think it drives me crazy. But before I get to that, let me talk about this. Her victory sort of only narrows the so-called conservative control of the Wisconsin State Supreme Court from 5-2 now down to 4-3. So will it have any practical effects, as you see it, John, on a court that has in recent years really become a rubber stamp in no small part for some of Scott Walker's most actual far-right, radical, right-wing policies, which, by the way, as you noted, Dalit's opponent Skrenik was instrumental in supporting. So, but they still don't have the progressives, the liberals still don't have a majority there. So will we yet see any changes to the actual court with her election?
You could see some individual changes. There are, as you point out, four identifiable conservatives. And, you know, by and large, they've been elected with support from the kind of classic conservative coalition in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty loyal to it. They're relatively loyal to Walker on things. They're especially loyal to some of these business interests, the predictable mm-hmm. money and politics kind of stuff. But they are individuals. And so, remember, this is the fear people always have about the courts, is that somebody you think is predictable may not be.
Mm-hmm.
And you were never going to get two of them to swing. But the possibility of getting one of them to swing on, you know, some sort of common decency, basic humanity issue.
Right.
Yeah, there's possibilities there, and you shouldn't underestimate that.
And it's a court that you have six out of seven of the justices are now women.
Well, there are, and that may be a factor in some areas, although, you know, many of the women are quite socially conservative as well.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing is, this is why a side issue in this race that wasn't much talked about beyond the kind of, you know, deep recesses of Wisconsin politics is a big deal. That is the issue of recusal. The question of, should members of the court
mm-hmm.
refuse to rule in cases where one party to the case is one of their major backers, is somebody they've been closely aligned with politically. And Dalit ran on that. She said she personally would recuse from cases involving her, you know, most prominent supporters.
Yep.
That was a big deal. But she's also now creates this pressure on the justices. And so I do think there are possibilities for some different dynamics there. Remember, if two of the conservatives were to recuse, right?
Right.
Suddenly you have a liberal majority. If one of the conservatives recuses, you get a tie, and that sends it back to the appellate courts. In Wisconsin, the appellate courts are more liberal than the Supreme Court. So there's a lot of dynamics that are worth noting. But I'm just going to put all that aside and tell you, it's still a conservative court. What's important is that now, instead of having to pick up two seats to bring it back to a progressive or at least mainstream majority,
mm-hmm.
you only need one.
Yep.
That's a big deal. Secondly, this happened in the spring of one of the most volatile election years in the country. The first statewide race that really pitted left against right in this kind of way in the country in 2018. And the progressives won, and they didn't win by a little. They won because of a maximized, dramatic turnout of voters. And so in many ways, rather than looking at the internal court dynamics, one of the important things to look at is just what this signals about, you know, kind of where our electoral zeitgeist is.
Is this a case where, John Nichols, where you think she would have won because she's such a great candidate, Michael Skrenik was so terrible, or can this be chalked up directly to the anti-Trump, anti-Republican blue wave that is now moving through Wisconsin as you see it?
Yeah, I think it's about 20%, maybe 30% great candidate. Dalit was a remarkably skilled and disciplined candidate. Everybody noticed it. She worked very, very hard. And she was, you know, what you need to be in politics. Charming. Mother of three kids. When she talked about gun violence, she spoke about it in personal, you know, ways. It was very, very effective. Somebody who really worked the state well. She's a good candidate. About 30% I'd give you there.
In her...
About 70%.
Yeah. Oh. No, go ahead. Go ahead. 70%.
I'd say about 70% was the blue wave stuff. And the reason I say that is the guy that Dalit's replacing won 10 years ago. And he was such a horrible, indefensibly awful candidate and jurist. And he beat, like, a remarkably well-regarded, you know, veteran state jurist. So, no, there's a lot of evidence that being a good candidate, being a good judge, you know, in this political process is sort of, you know, lavished in money.
Right.
And, you know, and where the Republicans, frankly, and the conservatives had an incredibly well-oiled machine, they historically have been able to elect incredibly unappealing contenders to the high court. And Skrenik definitely fit into that category, but he was much better than the guy he's trying to replace.
Interesting. In her victory speech, you had mentioned this recusal. I wanted to ask you about this. She had, of course, decried special interests, money on both sides, she said. She repeated her vow to recuse herself from cases that involve groups that supported her. Now, doesn't that, A, put the court at a disadvantage if she removes herself from cases involving groups that supported her? And one of the groups who spent against her big was the NRA. You know, does that mean that she should now also recuse herself from cases that involve the NRA in Wisconsin? If she's going to take herself out of those, you know, cases that where the group supported her, shouldn't she also take herself out with groups that...
That is the actually absurd argument that some of the conservatives made.
Is it absurd? Is it really?
Well, I'll tell you why it's absurd. I'll tell you why it's absurd.
Yeah.
If I refuse money from you,
yeah,
does that make me beholden to you? Or does that make me beholden to those that don't like you? No. She said, I'm not going to take their money. I don't believe that we should. Now, that's expressing a opinion. She clearly did that. But she did not take money from the NRA. Now here's the interesting
thing. They spent money on her. If she has a case, even if it's just the appearance of conflict of interest, she knows that the NRA is in court and they spent you know, millions of dollars to keep her from becoming elected. I mean, I'm not trying to go after Dalit specifically, but it all comes down to the point I raised earlier that I'm troubled by, you know, these are ostensibly nonpartisan races, but clearly you've got, you know, one side supported by Democrats, the other side supported by Republicans. And what we end up with is, you know, I think a court, whether it's the progressives or the conservatives, who are basically fighting for their own special interests because of these, because they're forced to run for elections. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. In fact, this is one of the reasons why, you know, if you're going to have an elected judiciary, you have to have publicly financed elections with, you know, real campaign finance control.
Right.
But luckily, the U.S. Supreme Court has ripped that reality apart. But where you're getting at is a legitimate point. Here's the way that recusal has historically worked, you know, a good recusal system.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that somebody who has expressed an opinion on a matter, right, doesn't necessarily have to recuse.
Right.
You know, if you said, well, my feelings are this. And when you're saying, I'm not going to take money from these people, I do believe you can have sensible gun control. That's expressing an opinion. There's no doubt of that. But that's very, very different than having a group spend, you know, millions of dollars to keep you from being on the court. And here's where the subtlety comes in. Just take a look at what Dalit said. Dalit said she favors gun ownership. She thinks people have a right to own guns. She was very blunt about her, you know, sympathy for people who are hunters and things like that. She just said, you know, there are certain places where it seems to be constitutional to do some sensible gun controls.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the position she took. That's what she herself said. The fact that somebody would attack her for that doesn't mean she shouldn't have to recuse for expressing her opinion.
No, but they are spending money, lots of money against her.
Well, there's no doubt of that. But you realize that if we started to set that standard, you would end up having everybody have to recuse from everything, right? You'd always find somebody that would spend $1 here, $10 there, $1,000 there. And so I agree with you. I'm on your side of this argument. But in the practical reality of where the courts are,
mm-hmm.
if you set a basic recusal standard that, you know, is rooted in, you know, where it's very clear, and reasonable people can determine that there was an effort to by one of the parties to tip the balance, then that's a point at which recusal becomes appropriate. And the new recusal rules in Wisconsin that Dallet supported actually have money figures and mm-hmm. you know, structural legal definitions for this. And if some group supporting her or even opposing her in the right context, you know, hit those limits, she should recuse. You're right.
Well, and I'm really it's the larger picture that I'm looking at, John. It's not that I'm saying, oh, she should recuse herself from NRA cases. But, you know, if she's going to do it on one side, it feels like she should do it on the other. But the larger issue to me is, again, Supreme Court justices, really any judges running for elections. I mean, she is, you and I would both agree, she espouses some great progressive views in her mm-hmm. victory speech, for example, on Tuesday. Let me play a very quick clip here. It sounded to my ears more like a politician than a jurist. Let me just play a clip here.
We not only won this race tonight, we've lifted up the issues that matter and that put us on firm ground for the future. I have a few more months on the Milwaukee County bench before I head over to Madison. And as a local county judge, I know we need to keep our community safe from violent crime, and that means holding the worst perpetrators accountable. But more than that, it means addressing the root causes of crime. We need to address the drug crisis as a public health issue. We need to confront racial bias in our criminal justice system. And we have to speak out when our civil justice system is undermined. We have to address the tremendous impact on our community from mass incarceration and brutality from the authorities.
Now, of course, I am in favor of all of those things, as I suspect you are, John Nichols. But the fact that all of, you know, that she's making speeches like that, all of these groups and politicians get behind one or the other candidate, doesn't all of this underscore, she sounds like a great politician, but doesn't it sound like the idea that, you know, the election of judges is just a terrible idea that needs to end? She's a judge here, not a political candidate for office.
Well, I'm afraid this is where you and I, who are in agreement on almost every issue,
mm-hmm.
May differ. Having been born and raised in Wisconsin, and I'm the son of a prosecutor and a county court commissioner, and kind of grew up in the courthouse in mm-hmm. Racine, Wisconsin, I just grew up, you know, in the world of elected judges. And there's an old Wisconsin tradition that the judiciary has to be accountable. It can't just be appointed by governors or even by blue ribbon panels. That ultimately, there should be the ability of the people to remove a judge or to put somebody on the bench. That's a old Wisconsin progressive value that runs deep in the state. Now, that comes into profound conflict with money and politics. And I think judges have a right, and I would argue it's fine for judges to express their broad sentiment, you know, the things that they think mm-hmm. are important, that they want to address, things that they're concerned about. I don't have a problem with that because I don't really like the idea of judges as, you know, high priests who are cloistered away and we don't really know, you know, what they think or where they stand. So I'm not too bothered by people expressing sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
What I am bothered by is the possibility, in fact, I think because of my views about money and politics, the probability that a a judge who might actually have good values and good ideals and some good sentiments could be warped in their position by the infusion of tremendous amounts of money into a campaign on their behalf or you know, in some other way to influence the election. So I do think I make a distinction between some of the money and politics issues and some of the expression of sentiments, expression of opinion issues. And you might end up on a different side of that, and I understand. But, you know, historically in Wisconsin, we had a system where you had people that you understood to be conservative judges, and you had people that you understood to be liberal judges. And, you know, that was happened all the time. But this is really, really different, what's going on now. And it is a bigger problem. And that is that now you have judges who, there's an awful lot of evidence that they are aligned to a political project, i.e., that, you know, their conservatism or liberalism is really secondary to their commitment to certain individuals and to certain political, you know, political parties or political groupings. And that's where the problem comes in. And believe me, I know that this is a nuanced and frankly rather deep argument that people end up on many sides of. But where the challenge is in Wisconsin is in the money and politics reality. The fact of the matter is the historic model for elections in Wisconsin was that candidates for judge raised a reasonable amount of money and then they went out and spoke a lot and they debated and they talked. That's not what's happening now. Now what's happening is that, you're right, you do have these essentially partisan contests that are massively warped by money. And so Wisconsin's going to have, like many states, and believe me, this is not just a Wisconsin phenomenon.
Right.
Wisconsin and other states are going to have to wrestle, as California is too. Remember, California, you have a weird system where somebody gets appointed, but then they have to be confirmed by the people.
A retention elect. Hey, leave California out of this, John. This is not.
And they spend like unimaginable amounts of money on elections.
Well, they do. There is impeachment. There is retention elections. And your argument for, you know, publicly funded elections, I think that would take a lot of the concerns out of this. We'll have to leave this because I'm running ridiculously long at this point, John. Folks can drop me an email if you have thoughts on this, bradcast@bradblog.com. John, let me get one quick thought from you before we go here. One of the Democratic challengers to Republican U.S. House Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin was raising money immediately off the Dalit win on Tuesday night. That would be Randy Bryce. He called the win, quote, a rallying cry for working folks. I'm going to need you to do this in about 15 or 20 seconds, but is there any actual chance that Paul Ryan could actually lose? And by the way, what are the chances that he decides to quit rather than run this November?
Number one, the chance he could lose? Increasingly good. If indeed it's a blue wave election, his district is gerrymandered in his favor, but it's not so gerrymandered that a blue wave could not push him out. He's really in a bad place. He's got tons of money, but people are pretty up in arms about him. Secondly, the chance that he'll quit. I have known Paul for a long time. I really doubt that he'll quit because he's an incredibly loyal Republican. And if he were to step down now as the Speaker of the House and say, oh, I'm not going to run, I think the impact on the party would be so devastating that a bad year could turn dramatically worse. So I think his party loyalty may be what keeps him running this year.
I will look forward to having you back when you are proven either right or wrong on either of those predictions. John Nichols, check out his work, as always, at thenation.com and Wisconsin's Capital Times. And also follow the Uprising as it continues on the Twitters at Nichols Uprising. Oh, and buy his book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. John, always great to talk to you, my friend. Look forward to doing it again very soon in the near future.
You're great, Brad. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, brother. Okay, we're running late, so quick break, and we are back with more election news way up north in Alaska. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast.
Way up north to Alaska. Way up north to Alaska. North to Alaska. Go north for us, your song.
Yep. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Des, we were talking to John Nichols over the break there, and he wanted to underscore, we didn't get to spend much time on it, but this ballot proposition that was soundly, hugely defeated.
Yes, it sounded like
Wisconsin.
A big deal.
It was a big deal. This was Scott Walker's attempt to do away with the statewide office of the treasurer. And basically, it was a huge power grab for the executive office, for Scott Walker. And John said that he thought that, you know, that Walker was talking about this thing as if it was a done deal, as if it was going to pass and do away with the state treasurer. And instead, that measure got absolutely trounced, something like, what was it, 60-30 or something.
He said, 62-38 or something incredible, which is very important because of the disposition of Wisconsin's public lands and, of course, funding for public education.
Yeah, so a lot of big news, a lot of good news for Democrats in Wisconsin as the blue wave continues to build, and also good news way up north in Alaska. Initial results in Anchorage's local election on Tuesday night showed a majority of voters rejecting a contentious ballot initiative to regulate restrooms, locker rooms, and intimate facilities by sex at birth instead of gender identity after what was one of the most expensive campaigns in city election history, according to the Anchorage Daily News. This was Proposition 1 in Anchorage, which would have rolled back legal protection for transgender people from a city non-discrimination law that has been in effect without problem for more than 2 years. But that effort appears to have been defeated. The results could change in the coming days. There are still about 16,000 votes that are still out. But as of Tuesday night, about 54% of the ballots counted were no votes on that Proposition 1 compared to 46% in favor. As I say, the numbers could still change, but it's looking very good for the folks who support freedom and oppose hatred and bigotry, even up in so-called very red Alaska.
I'm glad to hear that. Hey, when the people vote, the people win.
Katie Ward, campaign manager for the Fair Anchorage campaign, which had opposed Prop 1, said the Anchorage transgender community has stepped up and led this campaign in an amazing, powerful way. She said, while we don't have all the results tonight, we are cautiously optimistic. In spending, since elections seem to be all about spending these days, the Fair Anchorage campaign dwarfed its opponents. Finance reports show that the Yes on One Protect Our Privacy campaign, which is a local version of what right-wingers have been describing nationally as a bathroom bill, that was coordinated by the group Alaska Family Action. They spent about $123,000 on the effort as of late March, while Fair Anchorage was apparently able to raise and spend at least $800,000 in opposition to this scheme that would have gutted the city's non-discrimination law. So, good news. Good news up in Anchorage.
Yeah, but it's just really insane that this much money gets spent to try to deprive people of their rights. It's insane that this is where we are in 2018.
Yep, that is where we are in 2018, I'm sorry to say. Here's also where we are. I mentioned last week that the Missouri Republicans, at least a Missouri Republican in the state Senate, was proposing a bill to move away from the 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems that are used in some of the state's largest counties, for example, in St. Louis County, in Kansas City. The bill would replace those systems with hand-marked paper ballots, not an unverifiable computer-marked paper ballot, which seems to be all the rage now these days, like the one that Georgia was attempting to move to last week before that measure was killed by election integrity and transparency champions in the state. But this Missouri Republican is calling for an actual hand-marked paper ballot system ballots that are actually verified by the voters, and hand-marked paper ballots are specifically described as such in that legislation. Well, some good news for voters in Missouri. While the measure must still be approved in the state Senate, it was overwhelmingly adopted by the Missouri State House. The Missouri Senate is now considering, according to AP, whether to permanently unplug the state's touchscreen machines amid concerns that electronic voting machines might be susceptible to hackers. That's how AP described it. Might they? Who knows? Maybe.
Who can say?
Maybe touch 100% unverifiable systems. Maybe they're susceptible.
Whatever AP does, they should not look up the Senate hearing testimony of the Department of Homeland Security saying that they are hackable.
Don't worry. Apparently, they didn't look up anything. In any event, I digress because I like AP. Usually, they're quite good.
Yes, they are.
The proposal passed the GOP majority House overwhelmingly in a 108-31 vote and would require voters to use paper ballots exclusively, and actually, as that legislation also states, hand-marked paper ballots exclusively, no barcoded paper ballots, no computer-marked paper ballots other than for disabled voters who choose to use an assistive device. Machines could still be used, computers can still be used to count votes under this measure, but systems that only recorded votes electronically would be phased out. They won't be barred, they won't be banned immediately, but they cannot be replaced. And there's a lot of money now that is being put forward to states all over the country, thanks to Congress, who just allocated about $500 million to new systems. So as these older systems are phased out, at least in Missouri, if this measure passes in the Senate, they will, my own old home state, the Show Me State, would move to hand-mark paper ballots, period. The bill's sponsor, Republican Representative Paul Kirtman of Washington, Missouri, said the proposal would help ensure, quote, the highest confidence in the integrity of our election system. And he is, this Republican representative, is mostly correct. We'll set aside the issue of the computers that will be counting those hand-marked paper ballots. But at least voters will have a fighting chance to know that how voters voted, what the intent of the voter actually was, because a hand-marked paper ballot, by its very definition, is verified by the voter. Every county in Missouri already uses at least some paper ballots. About 24 counties, however, also use electronic voting machines that do not require a paper ballot, according to AP. During a debate on the House floor, Representative Pat Conway, Democrat of St. Joseph, Missouri, expressed concern that the proposal would force local governments to spend money they might not have. Democratic Representative Doug Beck of St. Louis, who also voted against the proposal, said that he had faith in the electronic machines that are used in his district. That's right. The Republicans and the Democrats in Missouri are completely flipped on this issue. And actually, I shouldn't say they're completely flipped, because there's a lot of Democrats around the country who are
who get this. Yes.
Well, actually, who don't get this. There's a lot of Democrats who don't get this, who are out there fighting for these computer marked paper ballots, or they think, oh, the voting machines that got me elected are fine, so we don't need to change them. What? They're 100% unverifiable? I don't care. They work to get me into office. That's just fine. Democratic Representative Beck said, quote, there would have to be a widespread conspiracy going on to rig those machines.
Oh, boy.
Right? It's exactly what you've heard Republicans say for years when we brought this up. Beck, again, a Democrat, said the vote tallies in electronic machines are more accurate and produce a paper record, said Beck. Now, in Missouri, the touchscreen systems they have spit out those little paper trails those computer printed paper trails supposedly of how the voter voted, but they are not necessarily verified by the voter. And of course, the computers don't use that little paper trail. It is a chimera. It is an illusion to make you think that the computers are going to count it the way the paper trails are printed. But no, they don't use that paper. They count it any way. The computers count it any way they want. Legislative researchers estimated that reverting to paper ballots would not cost the state government money, but they said that costs to local governments were hard to calculate. For example, the St. Louis County Director of Elections estimated that printing additional paper ballots before the next presidential election would cost almost $250,000. Well, God forbid. God forbid we should spend that and know how voters are actually voting. In Missouri, go Republicans and Democrats, figure it out. Get your goddamn act together and figure out what the hell you're doing and stop opposing stuff just because it's coming from Republicans in that case. One related story here sent to me by Christian McLaughlin, our station director at the our great affiliate, WLRI in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Apparently, the Department of State in Pennsylvania is taking steps to, quote, modernize Pennsylvania's elections by issuing an invitation for bid, or IFB, to voting system firms. Much of Pennsylvania, you'll recall, does use 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems, largely across the entire state in Pennsylvania. So now they're looking to get rid of those systems and move to new ones. That is, in theory, a good thing. Acting Secretary of State Robert Torres said that the new requirements for these systems will ensure that our voting systems will provide enhanced standards of resiliency, auditability, and security for Pennsylvania citizens. Now that sounds good, doesn't it? The IFB, the invitation for bid, includes requirements for increased documentation, security, and reporting capabilities, and requires that all voting systems purchased from February 9 forward must employ a voter verifiable paper ballot or voter verifiable paper record of votes cast by the voter. Not verified by the voter, but verifiable, maybe, if the voter wants to. Who knows? Those, of course, are the weasel words that you need to watch for, because they will allow computer-marked and or barcoded paper ballots in Pennsylvania and elsewhere across the state. People on the ground need to get it. They need to understand. If you see verifiable, that's not what you want. You want verified paper ballots, period. And we need citizens now all over the country to step up here and make sure that any new system, whether it's in the great Keystone State or anywhere else, allow for hand-marked paper ballots. Everyone in all the states now are going to have to do this, because Congress has allotted this $500 million to update voting systems around the country, and the private vendors are absolutely salivating at this point. They are already out like sharks, and they are counting on elected officials and election officials and the public to not know the difference between what they call voter marked paper ballots or just paper ballots. Which, you know, these voter-marked paper ballots, that is code word for computer-marked paper ballots. If they wanted actual hand-marked paper ballots, they would say hand-marked. But no, they say voter-marked because, oh, just use that touchscreen yourself, voter, and that will print out a ballot that you have marked through the computer touchscreen. So watch out for voter-marked paper ballots. Or if they just say paper ballots, because that would allow for unverifiable computer-marked ballots, unverifiable ballot code, barcoded ballots, instead of hand-marked paper ballots. Everyone on deck. All hands on deck, if you will. In Pennsylvania. Thanks for sending that to us, Christian. Greatly appreciated. And since I can't be everywhere, I can't be in all 50 states, we really need the people to step forward the way they did in Georgia, where they prevented those barcoded ballots just last week. So good news in Georgia. Now we just have to worry about the other 49 states. A quick break, and when we return, this week marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. at a motel in Memphis. Our brief remembrance of that awful night 50 years ago today is next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
Could you lower those signs, please? I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight.
Direct from our newsroom in Washington, in color, this is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street. In the friend's words, the bullet exploded in his face. Dr. King had returned to Memphis only yesterday, determined to prove that he could lead a peaceful mass march in support of striking sanitation workers, most of whom are Negroes.
Dan Rather, reporting for CBS News from New York. The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was shot to death by an assassin late today as he stood on a balcony in Memphis, Tennessee.
Confused and shocked city tonight. No one can believe what has happened. It's been just a little over an hour since Dr. Martin Luther King died from an assassin's bullet. King was shot as he stood on the balcony in front of room 306 in the Lorraine Hotel. He was alone. His aides were in the room behind him. Dr. King was rushed to St. Joseph's Hospital emergency room. He died at 7 o'clock Central Standard Time.
In a nationwide television address, President Johnson expressed the nation's shock.
America is shocked and saddened by the brutal slaying tonight of Dr. Martin Luther King. I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King, who lives by nonviolence.
Dr. King had this to say last night about the situation in Memphis.
Somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest for rights.
Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are. What direction we want to move in.
And it's still appropriate to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. That was Bobby Kennedy, who would himself be assassinated just 2 months later in 1968, announcing the death of Martin Luther King 50 years ago today in Memphis. King was fighting not just for racial justice, but was focused on union rights in the week that he was killed. And here we are 50 years later, and our nation is still asking itself what kind of nation we are, what direction we want to move in. Perhaps we received some small answer from yesterday's elections in Anchorage, Alaska, and particularly in Wisconsin, where the Supreme Court candidate who was instrumental in fighting to strip public union rights in Wisconsin back in 2011 was soundly defeated in the state's Supreme Court election by a progressive candidate fighting for the rights of all of us. My thanks to Desi Doyen and our old friend Tony Sorrentino, who put that montage together some years ago.
Yes, yes, we did.
And I think
it still stands today.
Yes, it does. Still horrifying to hear it today. So thank you guys very much for that. Thank you, Des, for all of your work, as ever, as our producer. My thanks also to our guest today, Wisconsin's own John Nichols of The Nation, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is, as ever, greatly appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other that we have ever done, you can download them anytime for free at bradblog.com. You can drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I hope you will find us, follow us, and share our shows and everything else far and wide on the Twitters and Facebooks at The Brad Blog. My thanks as ever to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate, because you are the ones who keep us on your public airwaves. We don't have those great big corporate supporters like other folks do and like these candidates now do all over the country. We rely on you, our listeners, to keep up this fight for all that is good and right. All right, that's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. Free at last, that's with you.